You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Who I hope we will turn up very shortly. I'm very pleased to be asked to moderate this panel. My name is Paul Kurtz. I'm the Executive Director of the Cybersecurity Industry Alliance, and we focus on the public policy space of privacy, integrity, and the availability of information systems. All of you obviously have in front of you the program, and you know what the session is about today. We have three, and soon to be four, I hope, distinguished panelists to join us here today. And just very briefly to set up, because you're not here to hear me, you're here to hear the panelists. We've obviously had a series of serious security breaches over the past year and a half or so that have come to light because of the California law passed a few years ago. We have laws law in place to address spam. We've got a bill or two out there to address phishing issues. We have spyware legislation that's being contemplated. We have at least 23 states that have put in data breach notification laws. So obviously, it's fair to say that legislators and in government is getting involved in the information security space. And so what we want to do today is explore that. And with me this afternoon is David Kubik, who is with the Energy and Commerce Committee. Many of you know him. He's central to what's happening as far as the debate on data breach notification on the Hill. I also have Steve with me from the Association of Computer Technology, and of course, Ari Schwartz.
You have to turn on your mic.
Oh, we can't hear you.
Okay, thank you for letting me know. We may have. Try this one. Better? Worse? Non-existent?
Hello?
Let's try this one.
Can you hear me? This one? Okay, I'm sorry, this one was. Can you hear me now?
All right.
I'm not going to repeat what I just said. I think some of you heard part of it. We obviously have David here. We've got Steve here as well, and Ari from CDT. And the planned format for the panel is I've got, if you will, one question that I'm going to ask each panelist to get things rolling forward, and then we'll go back through and have some follow-up. I want to encourage conversation among the panelists themselves to ask each other questions. And with that, I think we'll roll forward. I do want to bring out a few themes today of what is the role of the federal government versus the states in information security. I want to talk about or try to get at incentives versus the regulatory hammer here, what needs to be done with regard to regulation. Like to talk about what is the role of industry best practices. And if you will, we have a sector by sector or problem by problem approach versus a comprehensive approach. So I think we'll get into some of these issues as we go. Let me begin with David. David, obviously the House Energy and Commerce Committee has been active in the data breach notification legislative area. Congressman, the chairman, spoke this morning about working towards markup next week. I just wondered if you could kind of lay out the committee's approach towards this issue, what all's involved in the bill, which I understand is bipartisan, and what its prospects for success are.
I'll be happy to do that. Can you hear me? I sound a little bit like a frog, as I've been suffering from a cold like most everybody. How much time?
We have a total of 50 minutes, so
five minutes for the other.
5 minutes for each, and then we'll roll back through again.
All righty, very briefly, it's exciting to be here today. I see a number of friends in the audience, and for risk of offending some, because I actually can't see the people in the back, my colleague from the committee, Alan Roth, is here. 10 years ago today, the President signed the Telecommunications Act of 1996. A number of the old-timers were over at the Library of Congress for that, and that was an important day for the Internet, and Congress did a couple of good things by not doing anything. We intentionally stayed away from regulation of the Internet, and we intentionally stayed away from taxing the Internet, which were two important decisions, and sometimes the best things that the government do is to do nothing at all. Brooks Dobbs is here today. He was very helpful to us in our development of anti-spyware legislation. Jean McGinley, my colleague who runs our systems, is here today, and she's an important informal advisor to the ex-securities lawyers on the committee staff who now have to do tech policy. And my friend David Sohm is here from CDT, with whom I had the great pleasure of working when he worked for the junior senator from Oregon. You specifically asked about the committee data security initiative. This is a pretty straightforward bill that a number of you are familiar with. It follows a model.
Pull the mic in, they can't hear you.
Beg your pardon?
Pull the mic in, they can't hear you.
Sorry.
Is better? There seats up front. I mean,
better?
Come sit up front, too.
The data security bill is a very straightforward bill, and it follows a model that has been that has driven a lot of the congressional consideration of e-commerce. That you'll have a defined problem, a number of states will act with conflicting or differing solutions to that problem, and stakeholders will come to the Congress and say, "Will you provide us with a uniform national system of regulation?" That's what happened in spam. That's what we aspire to do in spyware. There have obviously been a number of data breaches. There's an open question as to the consumer harm caused by those data breaches. It's clear that they're a fairly common occurrence. It's clear that when ChoicePoint was selling data about consumers to Russian and Nigerian criminals, that there was bona fide consumer harm there. But many data breaches do not result in consumer harm. California has a statute that requires notification of California residents on an acquisition basis without a risk-based standard. So there's been discussion in the Congress about replicating a nationwide notice regime, minimal security standards, and a preemptive piece. No fewer than six committees are working on legislation like this, and it's almost a case study of interlocking congressional jurisdictions and the ability of relatively creative committee lawyers to write solutions to a public policy problem, in differing statutes. Ivy from the Senate Judiciary Committee, we hope, is going to join us, and she can talk a little bit about what Senators Leahy and Specter are thinking about in the Judiciary Committee. So the bill that we put out for comment, I think we're on a fourth round of comments, and we got 26 of them on Monday, so we have a little work to do that I expect the chairman will want us to do before we actually go to markup. Involves the trigger under which notice would be provided to consumers. On the one hand, you want consumers to take a notice of a security breach very seriously if they are at risk of identity theft. I was one of the staffers who worked on Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which was one of the first, really the first federal privacy law considered in the e-commerce era. How many of you have received notices about privacy policies from your financial institutions under Gramm-Leach-Bliley on an annual basis in the 10 years since it's been passed? Show of hands. Those of you who aren't showing your hands are lying, because I know you all have credit cards. How many of you have read those privacy policies?
Oh, this is the privacy room.
All right. That is the highest percentage I have ever gotten when asking that question. I drafted the provision and I don't read them. So there has been some discussion about what type of a risk trigger that we should have. The FTC recommended a significant risk trigger. Some of my Democratic colleagues have suggested a more permissive trigger, replicating that in California. So that's something that we're kicking around. I'm an old securities lawyer, and we are thinking about some concepts of materiality for the trigger. There's been a robust debate about robust encryption. We don't think that if we want to encourage companies to take steps to protect data. We think that technology is better than statutes. So we suggested that data that was encrypted would be presumptively compliant with Section 2 and Section 3 of the bill and not be, require nationwide notice in the event it was lost. Some technology companies have suggested that we should expand that to other technologies which either exist now or may be developed, and there's some talk of perhaps having the FTC give them the authority to add technologies to the encryption technology. That's something under consideration. And a third issue deals with the difficult problem of giving consumers access to information dossiers maintained about them by information brokers. And the problem that you have there is that if you ask if any adult, if the question is posed, an entity is maintaining a file about you, including sensitive information about you, and you don't have any right to see it, the natural human desire is to want to be able to inspect that dossier. I mean, many a high school movie has been built around that premise. And the members of both parties are strongly supportive of that notion. A similar concept exists in the Fair Credit Reporting Act. At the same time, we recognize that some databases are made up of people who have criminal records or have a propensity to criminal behavior, and that these databases are useful in terms of reducing the transaction costs in the information economy of people who engage in illegal activity by stealing or engaging in fraud. And if you give access and correct or access and inspect rights to folks, obviously the people who are most inclined to exercise those rights could be doing so for nefarious purposes, to defeat the purposes of the databases. And we currently are grappling mightily with that question. I don't have a good solution to it. We did get 26 comments, having asked for comments on Thursday, so I'm hoping that some of the smart people in this room and elsewhere are going to provide some guidance to us. I expect Chairman Barton is going to want us to go through the comments and be responsive to them prior to moving the bill to full committee markup. And with that, I yield back the balance of my time.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much, David. And going to Chairman Barton's comments this morning, where he talked about a wider approach to privacy and security of the Internet, I wanted to, if I could, shift down to Ari to expand from. We have several bills obviously in play about looking and focusing on the security of sensitive personal information as it relates to data brokers, but Ari, we have, you know, sector-specific regulations out there. We've got several laws to deal with other parts of information security. Are we taking a silo-based approach too much, and do we need to have a more comprehensive approach? I'd ask you to comment on that, and then we'll move on to Steve.
Well, CDT has long been behind the idea of a comprehensive approach, at least for coming up with a baseline standard. In certain areas, we think that, you know, it makes sense to look at different sectors differently, but as a general rule, to make sure that we have overall coverage and we're not legislating one at a time, we think that it's made sense for years now to take a general online look at online privacy, and even beyond that, look at privacy issues in general, offline and online, in a legislative baseline legislative framework. I think the interesting thing now, and the reason that this is coming up again and again, the reason that the chairman raised this again when he was asked this question again today, is because we've been hearing a lot more from companies who are in this space. Microsoft obviously made their announcement in support of general privacy legislation. It was a strong statement that they made. HP and eBay and Intel have all made statements over time supporting general privacy legislation. And we're also hearing from a lot more companies behind the scenes who are who support the idea of general privacy legislation. They're not necessarily willing to come out publicly and say it at this point, but we think that we've seen major movement in the past few months toward this idea. And that's for three reasons. The first is the one that is the issue that has been around for for 8 years now, the idea that there is a lack of consumer trust for network services, and privacy and security issues are a major driver for that, for the lack of trust. While those services continue to grow, and we expect them to continue to grow, the question is, are they growing at the rate that they could if we can address privacy issues and make consumers feel more secure and comfortable about it? We had, I forgot the numbers from RSA that were discussed today from RSA, but they gave some numbers from polling that they've done about the number of consumers who have said that they've held back from doing things online because of privacy concerns, and those numbers are growing, according to from what he was saying. And then we also hear from Consumers Union that 20%, between 20 and 30% of people, Jeff Fox is in the room, he can confirm the numbers for me since I don't have them directly in front of me, but have actually stepped back from using online services because of concern. So at one point they were using more and they intended to use more, and they've stepped back from doing that. And the question is, how do we, can we continue to do that? At what point do we hit the ceiling there? Obviously we are going to continue to grow, but where are we hitting the ceiling in terms of the potential growth that we could have if we did have stronger protection out there? But then we have these other issues that keep coming up. One is this is the legislative and legal collage that's out there today of different sector-specific laws and different technology-specific laws that keep popping up. And yes, maybe it's a lobbyist dream here to have a continual area where they can keep fighting this battle again and again for each new, keeping their sector out of specific legislation. But for the consumer, that's not, and as the chairman said today, for America, that's not the way that we should be looking at this kind of protection. We've seen, you know, I can go through the litany of sector-specific laws, but from the number of people that raise their hand about reading GLB statements, I assume that a lot of people here know about GLB and HIPAA and the Cable Act and the Telecom Act and the privacy standards in each of those, and you know, utilities and on and on of the different standards we have for many, many industries that are all at different standards or use different terminology in one way or another. But then again, we look at the legislation that we have introduced now. We have spyware legislation. We have the data security issues. Representative Markey has said that he's going to introduce data retention for search queries, a bill on data retention for search queries. There's been this discussion about RFID, and there's been, I don't know what is introduced at this point in time and what's moving on that, but obviously that continues to come up. And we're starting to get more and more technology-specific with this legislation, and instead of trying to come up with a baseline and working from that baseline and trying to figure out how we're going to do that. So that's the area number two, and I think a lot of the companies that we've been speaking to are realizing that they just can't, I mean, that it's going to be more expensive to keep fighting these battles than to come up with some basic rules that they can live with. The last thing that we're hearing from companies, and probably the big driver for a lot of them, is the international marketplace. Internationally, U.S. laws are not as strong as in other markets, but the companies are following the higher standards. The multinational companies follow the higher privacy standards around the world, because the U.S. laws are not seen as sufficient in the other countries, they have to go and create model contracts with each company that they do business with in these other countries. So they have people. Some large multinationals have two or three people. All they do is review international contracts on privacy legislation. If we were considered to be sufficient, to have sufficient sufficient privacy standard, that would go away. And so there's a clear direct savings there that companies could see. And be able to move on to different things because they already meet. They're already meeting the stronger standard that's out there, and the stronger standard that we would have in U.S. law. So that's what we're hearing from companies today. I think that we want to work with companies and with public interest groups that want to see wise baseline privacy rules that work across the country. I think we're talking about if we get a high enough standard, it would be something that would preempt states from acting, but it would have to be high enough that where protections are really in place, and it means something internationally as well. It means something to the states as well.
Thank you very much, Ari. Steve, if we can turn to you now.
given what David and Ari have offered, and ask you to speak about, more generally, the potential pitfalls and advantages of government regulation in the area of security and privacy, and perhaps note the relationship between the federal government and the states, because we have many states that have actually passed laws. And then from there, I'm going to let the panel kind of flow among itself, because I imagine David and may have a comment or two from what's been said already. So over to you, Steve.
Thanks, Paul. And David, you were in your warm bed this morning at 8 o'clock when your boss, the chairman, gave me the first best answer for what the advantages are of legislation and regulation in this area. In fact, had you been here, you'd have been worried, because if you were there for the signing of that first Telecom Act, you'd learn that Chairman Barton covets the pen you may have. I would watch that. But he also said to us this morning, he said, when I get into my district or my newsletters, when it comes to data security, privacy, spyware, he called that a 95-5 favorable, a slam dunk. Chairman Barton said it's a slam dunk. That's the kind of bills you really want to move on. And that's precisely the most attractive part of legislation that occurs in the area of data security and privacy, both at the federal and state level. It's a very popular issue, and it's an easy one to move on. It's much more difficult to achieve consensus, but it's easy to get something started. That's the pro side. The con side of that is that the focus on brand new tailored legislation like that only delays what really needed to be done all along, and that is to enforce the laws that we currently already have. As Ari calls it, a baseline, such as the Federal Trade Commission Act, prohibitions against unfair and deceptive trade practices, or the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and Title 18. But while you're waiting for a new law that specifically articulates things, then there's a lot less activity and attention that goes to enforcing the laws we already have. And the good news is that I think Ari, we can point to Ari as a great example of someone who's used existing law in bold and aggressive ways to take down some spyware, adware providers. And I hope we're going to hear some more about that today, too. Now, one other advantage, turning back over to the pro side, one advantage of new legislation and regulation is that it can clarify. It can specifically articulate the offenses to make jobs easier for prosecutors. It can specifically articulate exactly what the bad behavior, good behavior is, so that companies know, legitimate companies would know where to navigate the minefield. Or in the case of security breach legislation, it might articulate exactly how one has to determine if they have to do a breach notice and how they do the notice or the alternative notice. And all that is very helpful. But at the same time, you have to remember that those specific guidelines are only followed, they're only followed by the good guys. They're followed by companies who have brands they want to protect, and so they therefore seek to follow the rules. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The very specific rules that were articulated in the CAN-SPAM Act, they certainly have affected the behavior of certain companies that want to follow the rules, but, well, I still get quite a bit of spam in my email box, and I'm sure that most of you do, too. I know that the ISPs are doing a great job filtering. There's been a business and industry response. But for the most part, we sort of gotten used to the fact that a lot of bad actors are going to ignore rules and try to slip under the wire anyway. That's certainly been the case with adware, with spyware, and with spam today. Another one I want to put in the disadvantage column with respect to new regulation is that it kind of freezes in place current sets of definitions of software, technology, and perhaps even behavior, both in the terms of saying what's proscribed and also how companies have to respond to a breach or removal requirement. That's a pitfall. So I would say that on balance, I'm a little concerned about new regulation when it takes away the emphasis on enforcement. But then I have to add to that balance the fact that the patchwork of state laws. Paul, I spend far too much of my time circulating amongst the state capitals and the state legislative groups like the NCSL and the ALEC, trying to work with a patchwork of state laws. When they pop up, you play whack-a-mole and zoom into a state capital to try to either slow it down, stop it, or, failing that, try to get it to conform to what the other states have already passed to avoid the notion of a patchwork. Because when each of the states act like they did, you pointed to the fact of 23 data security breach. We also had 28 bills in 05 on spyware. We've got half a dozen on phishing. We'll see a few more of online dating this year. We had a dozen bills on RFID in 2005. And the metaphor for this might be lost on us because it's been such a long time since we've seen snow. But these state bills are like snowflakes in a couple of regards. I mean, no two are alike. They're always different. There's a lot of them. And after they've fallen, they have a tendency to really get in the way and give them a mess. And they look real pretty at first, but that snow has a habit of accumulating and creating an absolute mess. And when that happens, a lot of us run to David here in Washington. So they bring in the federal snow plows, clear the mess away. And we should actually resist that temptation, I think. We should resist the temptation of pulling hard on the federal preemption snow plow and work a little harder with our individual snow shovels out there in the states to try to keep them from enacting bills that get in the way of e-commerce, especially on an interstate basis. So have that snow plow idling, David, but let's get the right bill before we have to drive on the streets.
David, can I ask you to respond with what Ari and Steve have laid out there? It's somewhat overlapping but largely differing approaches, and it's probably a little foggy for the audience out there as to exactly what we should do. So from a more comprehensive approach to information security, what would you offer to the equation?
Well, very briefly, because I want to hear from the audience questions. My boss, Chairman Barton, is very interested in comprehensive legislation, and we will be doing some hearings on that and maybe putting something together. Cliff Stearns has been an early leader, as has been Congressman Boucher. That being said, this is a question of tactics and strategy. I mentioned the Telecommunications Act, which became law 10 years ago. That was the first comprehensive rewrite of our communications laws since 1934. I was one of the lead counsels on repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. The first effort to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, which was passed in 1933, came in 1934 by none other than Carter Glass, one of the authors of the act, and it took over 65 years to achieve that goal. The bigger the bill, the more comprehensive the bill, the more difficult it is to legislate. We have moved anti-spyware legislation, which Ms. Bono and Mr. Towns authored. I think it's a very good bill, closely resembling some of the work that CDT has done, some of the work that Senator Wyden had done. It's not getting any traction in the Senate. It has an opt-in regime for spyware loaded onto one's computer, which seems to be, you know, probably the most egregious form of invasion of personal privacy, the use of technology to surreptitiously gather information about you without your knowledge. Yet there are legitimate stakeholder concerns with that have made it difficult to move that legislation in the Senate. So be careful what you ask for, because comprehensive privacy legislation will take many, many years to do. There are a very sophisticated audience, sophisticated government relations professionals and people involved in the technology industry. There are a wide divergence of viewpoints and important public policy considerations, and they're very difficult to do.
Thank you, David. Why don't we take David's suggestion and see if we've got any questions from the audience. I'm betting we do. I've got 3:05 on my clock, and we have to break this panel by 3:25 in order to make enough time for the next panel to come in and talk about sensitive personal information, more specifically in the medical and financial fields. But if there are questions, I would ask that you approach the center microphone, state your name and your organization, and then fire away.
Jeff Fox, Consumer Reports. I haven't heard a lot said here. Everyone seems to enjoy the pens they get from all the signings of these bills. But what about the funding of enforcement? You can pass a million bills, but if you have an unfunded mandate, it doesn't matter how many laws you have. Is the FTC and other agencies, do they have the resources that they need? Do they have the tools that they need?
Well, I mean, this is a very good point, Jeff. I think that there has been efforts to get more funding to the FTC. There was some discussion. There's some discussion every time that the chairman goes and discusses this and gets asked the question, do you have enough funding to do this? she usually starts out by saying yes, and by the end there's sort of a tenor of, well, maybe we need a little bit more out there as well. It's been our viewpoint that FTC does not currently have enough funding, and they don't have currently have the right enough education ability to learn about new threats. So there's kind of a ramp up time as well on new threats to the internet in particular, and we'd like to see them deal with that directly. We think that they understand that they need to work to do that more. But this is also the reason that we've also been supportive of the idea that, especially on broader pieces of legislation, that AGs have enforcement authority on privacy issues. The spyware bill actually doesn't do that, but then again, it doesn't do anything to take away the AG's existing authority under unfair and deceptive practice laws currently. And so, in our viewpoint, that's where most of these spyware cases, that's where most of the emphasis should be, is on those kind of cases, giving the AGs the authority, that the AGs will bring cases under their existing unfair and deceptive practice laws, and the FTC will bring it under the current unfair and deceptive practice laws. One thing that the House bill does that we think is a good thing is it raises the penalties on the bad guys. Now, obviously, those money, when we get penalties, that goes into the general treasury. But I think that there is an understanding there that the FTC is bringing in. I mean, if you look at the fines that the FTC has brought more recently on unfair and deceptive practices and other related to privacy, those numbers are starting to go up quite a bit, and so I think that there is funneling some of that back into the FTC would make sense. There's been a pushback to have all enforcement monies come stay within the FTC, but I think we're going to have to figure out a way to get more funding when they're bringing these kind of cases and we're seeing more egregious violations in this area.
Thanks, Arthur. Steve?
Yeah, and on that question of enforcement, we like to say that the states are the laboratories of democracy, and there are, I have to say, in all my work with the state, there are a lot of mad scientists in state capitals, and the crazier ones will show up when the question of enforcement is here. And sure enough, after the snowflake bill has been introduced at the press conference to a 95.5 approval rating, the state AG weighs in and says, you know, we really need to stick a private right of action for individual consumers into this. We need to protect consumers and link it to our consumer protection statutes and need to have statutory damages. And our first reaction coming in from industry is to say, well, of course, you know that all that does is empower the plaintiff's bar to go after the deep-pocketed good companies who might be too close to the line or over the line or inadvertently cross the line on behavior. The true bad actors, on the other hand, whether overseas or out of sight, always escape these private right of action, especially the class action. Well, the AG always has a great answer. He says, look, You're looking at my whole staff, she'll say. I've got two people handling the entire Commonwealth trying to enforce all of our consumer protection statutes. None of them know anything about Internet technology. If this bill passes, there'll be an expectation of the citizens of the state that we'll enforce it, and I can't do it myself. So they typically want to open up the door to the plaintiff's bar. Well, I have to suggest that one of the biggest incentives in enforcement comes from industry. So industry is often answered, and you'll see a number of state bills where industry will step up to the plate and say, look, spyware, for instance, is the number one support problem for ISPs, for companies like AOL, companies like Dell, companies like Microsoft. And given that, the companies want to spend their own enforcement resources investigating and assisting the AG in prosecuting. They'll even take a private right of action for a company to recover the actual damages they've incurred to remedy a spyware issue. So you'll often see a number of these state bills, and again, there's 23 of them, as Paul talked about. There's private right of actions built into them, not for individual citizens and statutory damages, but we try to construct it so that actual damages can be recovered. So the enforcement equation comes down to who's got the resources to enforce it and what are all the alternatives. To what extent will industry do the enforcement in the courts? To what extent will consumers and the plaintiff's bar be allowed? And in all cases, we have to turn for help, I think, to folks like Ari, who shows up with a lot of investigatory information that makes it a lot easier for either the federal or state AG to bring a case.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, came from the APWG. I'm up there next, actually. That led to something that we have talked a lot of times at the Anti-Phishing Working Group, which is a lot of the privacy things, a lot of privacy breaches and stuff that we've seen. And in my real life as a security and risk consultant, we see a lot of privacy breaches which really aren't criminal, but they really peg the stupid meter. And so is there any thought been given to, instead of making the enforcement piece the beat the crap out of the company, is to try to do it on the incentive part, to say, let me explain to you why you should do this, so A, we don't have to beat the crap out of your letter, and you'll change your internal processes to fix it. I mean, a prime example is the Boston Globe last week, who printed 240,000 credit card numbers on the back of some paper, then recycled them and sent it out to their distributors. And it was, now there's 250,000 people's credit card numbers out there, and people are saying, oh my God, we should go, you know, cut the paper in half, we should go into bad things. And from the risk side, I look at it and say, you should fix your internal processes, because it was kind of stupid to print them out in the first place. And so has there any thought been given to the kind of the polite side, as opposed to beat them after it's too late problem?
Well, the notion of whitelists shows up in a lot of ISPs, Internet Service Providers, who will permit email to pass through their system if it satisfies certain requirements. And again, that doesn't cut down on the amount of spam that shows up in my email box. And I think it points to this distinction. The do not call rule was a stick, not a carrot, right? And it actually works pretty well. I do notice that I get a lot fewer telemarketing calls around house at dinner. That could be because I'm never home for dinner. But for any event, there are not too many calls I'm hearing about. But what about in spam? In do not spam, we haven't seen that come down. I think it's for two reasons. Telemarketing calls are easy to trace, and they cost money to make the call. When it comes to email, it's almost impossible to trace, and it's free. So incentives are not necessarily going to help in situations where the bad behavior is anonymous and free. So I think we do have to be more aggressive at using a big stick and publicizing the public hangings when we do catch somebody.
I just to follow up on, I think that this is really where self-regulation comes in. I mean, and APWG does a lot of the work in the phishing space, and the Anti-Spyware Coalition does work with anti-spyware companies, and Trustee is doing work with downloadables and in the privacy space, and Trevor standing right behind you does work with advertisers. So there are a lot of groups out there that try to get out the best, you know, the best practices. The question is, are we doing a good enough job, and are enough people signing up, and what happens to those people that refuse to engage in the self-regulatory schemes? So, I mean, we strongly support self-regulation, but it's not going to be enough in the end to protect consumers. We're going to need to be able to go after the people that do bad things, certainly, but stupid things that harm people as well. I think the line shouldn't be stupid. It should be stupid that harms people. And then, you know, we have to figure out what the line of harm is in terms of stupidity. But bad and malicious, obviously, there is something there that is a marker that we have to that exists today, and we should have to make sure it exists in law.
David, did you want to comment? I had a follow-up question, but I didn't know if you had any immediate comment.
We do have, I suppose, the carrot side are our minimum security standards, which we've included in the committee data bill, which have been borrowed from the Stearns privacy bill, which were largely developed as good practices with large technology companies.
Yeah, and the only thing that I did to drill down on this question a little bit, as far as incentivizing best practices, we note the California bill, which included the option of encryption, and you've included that in the data breach notification bill. To you, does that fall in the area of incentivizing best practices without mandating a best practice?
Well, we did provide a safe harbor for that, and we think that obviously, to the extent that encrypted data is lost and the keys are secure, or for that matter, other technologies that secure data, it's probably a better solution than any statute or FTC rule that we're going to be able to come up with. So a safe harbor approach is something that we've looked favorably on, that the members, Chairman Barton, is very supportive of.
See, if I could add to that, when it comes to things like security breaches, data security breaches, the companies have adequate incentive today to ensure that the data they're custodians of isn't lost or stolen, whether it's by criminals posing as customers, like Choice Point, or a tape that falls out of the back of a truck. They have tremendous incentives for that. A study that was done by Tom Leonard and Paul Rubin at PFF quoted that $55 billion was the costs last year of security breach that turned into identity theft. So it's really not the cost of security breach, it's the cost of identity theft. The bad thing that bad people do with the data that's stolen or lost. And that $55 billion was incurred 90% by the business community, by retailers, credit card issuers, who had to eat the cost of charges that can't be passed on to customers for fraudulent credit card bills or accounts that were opened outside of their name. Businesses have tremendous incentive, and the notion of a, did you call it a safe harbor with respect to encryption? The idea is to say that we want companies not only to do a great job to secure their data, and they have an incentive to do so, but they need to know clearly what the rules, because things will happen. The data can get lost, the data can be stolen, but if they've done a good job making it unusable, then they shouldn't have to go through the steps of doing notices that will only dilute people's sensitivity to when a real breach could occur.
Other questions from the audience? Please step forward to the microphone. In between times, if somebody wants to come up, another question I wanted to ask the panel. Senator Spector and Leahy have set forth a bill as well to address the security of sensitive personal information. Obviously, Avi's not here, but one of the characteristics of the bill that is interesting, it gets far more granular on what is required of firms in order to secure information. So when we talk about potential regulation in this space, how far should we go? How granular should we be as far as specifying what firms can do? I look at the DSW case that was just resolved by the FTC a couple weeks ago, and they had a very rigorous set of requirements that needed to be followed, similar in a way to what's in the Spector-Leahy bill. But I would ask the panel to comment on how specific should congressional legislation be in this space?
Congress is not institutionally well set up to do detailed rulemakings, particularly in the technology area where you have extremely complicated technical issues. Congress is very institutionally capable of setting general guidance, general rules, rules of general applicability as to secure your data, give notice to consumers if there is a risk-based breach. But to the extent that Congress begins to engage in something that resembles rule writing, and you put that in statute, you tend to get anti-competitive results.
Oh, to that I say amen.
Ari, I agree. I mean, I agree that we would be better off if industry could do it themselves and put together self-regulatory rules. And then the secondary preference would be to work with things that we've seen in, like, the DSW case where there is settlement and move forward off of existing pieces. And then the least preferable would be for Congress to do it in legislation. But I do think that that is far preferable than having continued ongoing breaches and nothing in place to do some to protect consumers. So at some point, you have to draw the line and say, you know, we passed the point of no return here. We know we have enough information. We have to do something. I think that it's debatable whether we're at that point right now, but in the California, I think the one place where I agree with everything that Steve said prior to this about the state statutes, except for the one place I disagree, is that the California law gave companies more incentive to do the right thing by putting in place transparency.
But interesting,
we're talking about preempting the states from doing more work in this mm-hmm. space, right? And we're talking about stopping that kind of innovation to build better marketplace mm-hmm. for security with a federal law. That means we have to put something in place that's pretty strong.
Strong to require the notice, which is a completely separate question than whether the government should prescribe the security technologies and steps that firms have to do to guard their data, which I think was Paul's initial question. Yeah. And to that, we're all singing from the same humble.
I agree with you, except for if you're preempting all that for the state from experimenting in that space, then you better put something strong in its place.
For transparency.
For the other pieces, if you're going to preempt the states from acting to set up security rules and exempt preemption there, you have to figure out what the way is to make sure that you have a strong security across the board, because we're stopping the states from acting in the future.
Well, GLB is a great example of that. GLB contains requirements in it for what financial services companies must do to protect the data. It's a very general, I believe, not a specific statement as to what they have to do to guard the data. They do best efforts to achieve that, but data breaches do occur in companies that are covered by GLB. And to the extent they are, they're completely carved out of any of the security breach bills in the states, and as far as I can tell, the ones in the U.S. Congress as well.
I'm totally biased, but I have to, I'll go up to the mic here and comment on one thing Ari just said, which is you said states should experiment in that space. From the business perspective, experiment means cost me money. And that's what's the scary part about it. I know, I just want to clarify, you know, if you want an opportunity to clarify it, I don't want states to experiment.
I was playing off of Steve's comment about the laboratories of democracy. So I meant towards protecting consumers, and obviously that is a key point. I take your point that you know, experimenting in security space is a risky venture
for
governments to come up with with new laws for the sake of coming up with new laws rather than for doing it for a specific purpose. I'm saying if we continue to see, and that's why I prefaced it with, if we continue to see breaches here, we're going to see the push for stronger and stronger laws. And so, again, I'd prefer for the industry to come up with self-regulatory solution. I prefer for this to be worked out the way that the FTC did in the DSW case, you can come to settlement in egregious cases. But if that continues not to happen, then what do we do at that point? And I haven't heard a good answer from industry today. And so that means you're going to see more experimentation out there if that does continue. Frank?
Frank Jones from the Harness of Security. David, my question first, to compliment you on the work that you've done on HR 4127, this is really a very good bill. We think a lot of thoughtful bipartisan work has gone into it. And we think the bill is fine as it is, and it really should be marked by committee, and hopefully very soon, and so you can move on to something else.
Well, we love compliments. Thank you very much. The chairman will be grateful.
And now, the question is, so we talked a lot about best practices, and when it comes to the exemption in the bill from the breach mitigation obligation, so that is to reduce false positives. It's also an incentive for companies to do the right thing and adopt the best practice. That's kind of the last line of defense if everything else has already been defeated. Right now, it's based on encryption, and encryption is a known best practice, and we think it really should stay in the bill. I've heard from some quarters that it should be broadened to other methods and techniques. Unfortunately, none of the suggestions that I've heard, obfuscation or others, are really best practices, and very often they can be easily defeated and give a false sense of security. So my question is, where do you see that going, and how do you see that being addressed and marked up?
Well, that's a good question. For those of you who are lobbyists, this is not a happy time to be a lobbyist given the public press, but the committee staff and the members rely on the expertise that you bring to help us understand these problems. I took a Smith Corona typewriter to college, as I think did many of you, and when my computer breaks, I call Jean and ask her to come help me. So what Frank is asking about is what kind of performance standards do we need to protect customer data? That's an important question, and we are not able to make that determination with any kind of rigor. There is some confidence among the members, among the staff who work for them, based on the testimony that we've heard and the research that we've done, that encrypted data with bona fide key management does provide essentially a complete protection to data from outside threats. As to these other proposals which which we are learning about, we don't know. And we need a mechanism, some kind of a performance standard to make that determination. And it's one of the reasons that Congress institutionally isn't well set up to do that. So we may give some authority to the FTC after notice and comment in accordance with the Administrative Procedures Act to make determinations about what other technologies could benefit from that. It's a question that has animated some of our leading technology companies. I've got representatives of two important trade groups with me on this panel whose members care deeply about this question. Is that responsive to...
May I on that one?
Sure.
I think it's a mistake. I don't know if Frank understands this business very well. It's a mistake to suggest that if the bill contains a safe harbor for notice if you have encrypted, that somehow constitutes the incentive to encrypt. Nothing could be further from the truth. The companies that hold this data, their incentive to not lose the data, and if it does get lost, to have it unusable, is that the consequences of losing it can mean going out of business. That credit card firm in Arizona lost their entire American Express account as a result of the breach that occurred there. More than 5% of the 50 million Americans who've been breached so far have already contacted a lawyer. 25 to 30%, according to the Ponemon Institute, have already canceled the relationship with the company who lost their data. Another 40% are considering doing so. So the companies have phenomenal incentive to protect their data, and if it does get stolen or lost, to make sure that it's unusable. And I have worked with companies as a consultant where we cut the databases up so that the names are not in the same table as the credit card numbers. So delinking the tables and encrypting the tables with whatever the industry standard technology for encryption was at the time. So there are many things that constitute a breach that is at risk. I think that's the term David used earlier, that he's only interested in forcing notification on at-risk breaches and at-risk losses. Encryption is one of the ways that the risk is reduced to the point where you may not have to do a notice. And if a company has done that, then the bill should be clear about it, that if it's encryption, I think it's implied that it's effective encryption. I don't believe we have to pull the rug out from companies who haven't spent the money to do the encryption by suggesting that we always have to be updating the law to some current state of the art that would favor a handful of companies that offer something better.
That will have to be the last word, because I promised I would have everybody out of here by 3:25. Thank you very much, and thank you to all our panelists.
Thank you.